perfectly solid cookie in my hand. "What's the matter?" I asked. "Don't you want it?" Moth wings on my palm. He'd tried again.
"Nice trick," Ascanio said.
"You said you could take all of my cookies, and you can't even grab one. I'm disappointed."
I raised the cookie to my mouth and took a bite.
"Mmm, delicious. You really don't know what you're missing."
He swiped at the cookie, trying to take it out of my mouth. His fingers fanned my lips.
"Hey, personal space!" Ascanio opened his mouth. A female shapeshifter dashed across the yard and slid to a stop next to Ascanio.
"I saw him!" Red burst in Ascanio's eyes. "Are you sure?"
"Yes!" She waved her hand in front of her. "I saw his face!"
"We'll finish this later." Ascanio spun to her. "Show me." They sprinted off into the darkness.
I stepped out and yelled, "Wait! You forgot your cookie!" A distant howl from Unicorn Lane was my only answer.
That was fine. I knew he'd heard me.
I went inside, sealed the ward, and closed the door behind me.
So, the pack, or some part of it, was definitely interested in this murder. Unfortunately, I still had no idea why.
Let's see. Things I learned from this encounter.
Ascanio was amazingly fast, and he wasn't shy about using money to get what he wanted. And what he wanted was Pastor Haywood's killer. Not a complete waste, but not terribly useful either. If the pack required access to a murder, they could request it through proper channels. Most of the time, the city let them in. They were the best trackers, and they made efforts to play nice with law enforcement. They also took care of their own criminals, so if a shapeshifter had committed this murder, the pack would do an internal investigation, apprehend them, and either punish or, depending on the political situation, turn them over to city authorities. It was a win-win arrangement. The pack avoided unnecessary suspicion, and the cops bled less trying to do their job. Subduing an enraged shapeshifter wasn't a walk in the park. But the pack hadn't requested access. They'd bribed a cop instead. So far, both Ascanio and Nick were interested in this case and pretending as hard as they could that they weren't. Nick's interest worried me. Years ago, before Nick became Knight Protector, he was a crusader, and his last assignment before his promotion was to infiltrate Roland's organization. Grandfather had done something to him, something awful neither of them ever talked about. The assignment had ended in a disaster, and Nick watched the entire chapter, 7 nights, be slaughtered by my other uncle who wasn't in his right mind. He never broke his cover. I couldn't even imagine how much of his soul that had cost him. He watched as the knights died and would have carried on his mission, except the asshole who was the Knight Protector then exposed him as he lay dying and made sure it was all for nothing. Nick had been volatile to begin with. That experience crystallized every crazy tendency he'd had. He had dedicated himself to opposing Grandfather in everything he stood for. Nick used to call Kate an abomination to her face. Kate didn't mind. He was the only son of her former guardian, and she viewed him as a brother and helped him any chance she got. That was the way she moved through the world. I should have resented Nick, but I didn't. He was a knight of the order in the truest sense, and he dedicated himself completely to the order's mission of protecting humanity against all threats. Kate represented a potential threat of catastrophic proportions. Kate was also Nick's friend, and if she needed help, he would drop whatever he was doing and ride over with guns blazing and swords bared, as he had more than once. He simply refused to see the conflict between those two things. He worked with Kate. He was genuinely fond of Conlan, and he went over to Kate and Curran's house for dinner, but he was always alert for any signs of Kate descending into madness. If she chose to become a tyrant, he would be first in line to run her through with his blade. It was possible that his years as the Knight Protector had stabilized him, but I highly doubted it. His paranoia was a bottomless, dark lake, and he was excellent at subterfuge. I went to the hallway, slid the secret door open, entered my real home, and shut the door behind me. It clanged in place with a reassuring thud. The Enki shield flowed closed, cutting off the outside world. I whispered a word, and the Fey lanterns ignited, bathing the chamber in bright yellow light. Yet another benefit of a classical education. My Fey lanterns came with a magic off switch and glowed in a variety of colors, while most people's Fey lanterns were blue and glowed continuously when the magic was up. I wasn't a fan of blue light, except as a rare accent here and there. Too harsh. I walked to my desk and sat in my chair. So far, this murder was all questions and no answers. I reached for the familiar connection in my mind, looking for Turgon. A light shone in my mind and unfolded into a view of a house with brightly lit windows. Nick Feldman sat at a kitchen table, by the first floor window, eating a sandwich and reading a thick book. The view tilted slightly as Turgon readjusted his grip on the branch. "Stay on him," I whispered. The raptor clicked his beak in acknowledgement. I let go, and the image faded. The eagle would call to me if anything happened. As long as the magic stayed up, I would know every move Nick made. Tomorrow, I would dig deeper, but before I could do that, I needed to figure out where to start. I pulled a big stack of papers toward me. I had picked them up on my way home, 3 months' worth of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Let's see if anyone announced their discovery of new Christian relics. 6. I rode out into the city at 8 a.m., unsupervised. Ascanio hadn't left anyone to babysit me. Maybe he decided I wasn't worth keeping an eye on. Maybe it slipped his mind. Both possibilities were equally unlikely, which meant whoever followed me was staying way back, tracking my trail. By the time I stopped by the blue house to hide the care package for Martin, I'd sprinkled Wolfsbane on my tracks twice. It wouldn't stop my tail, but why make it easy for them? 20 minutes later, I rode up to St. Luke's Methodist Church on the edge of Tuxedo Park. In the wake of the destruction brought about by the slow-motion magic apocalypse, the affluent of Atlanta fled north. Neighborhoods like Tuxedo Park had the bonus of being older, with historic mansions that fared much better than modern office towers and high-rises. While the skyscrapers fell and crashed, places like Via Juanita, the 10,000-square-foot signature tuxedo estate, suffered no damage, still as opulent as they had been a century and a half ago. St. Luke's Church straddled the divide between the wealthy of Tuxedo Park and the new business center that had sprung up along Peachtree Road. Calling it a church was a bit of an understatement. The massive cathedral, built with brick and white concrete, occupied 5 acres with its grounds and auxiliary buildings. A testament to the Stoic values of the Gothic Revival, the entire complex was a fortress, a hospital, a school, and an administrative center all arranged into a single neat rectangle with the cathedral front and center, looking like a smaller cousin of Notre Dame. A stretch of lawn bordered the cathedral, the killing ground, another fun real estate peculiarity of our apocalypse. A long walkway cut through the lawn, leading to a wide terrace before the stairway to the church. The terrace was filled with cut flowers. Roses, lilies, and wildflowers rested on the pavement, with candles burning between the blooms and small wooden crosses. The city had turned this space into a memorial to Pastor Haywood. A few mourners still remained, 3 days later, sitting on the low stone wall bordering the terrace and praying. I rode to the side parking lot, dismounted, tethered Tulip, and walked up to the doors on foot. A middle-aged white man with a receding hairline and wire-rimmed glasses met me at the entrance and gave my tattered cloak a long glance. Under the cloak, I wore a green t-shirt, a pair of comfortable brown pants secured by a belt holding pouches of herbs, silver dust, and other useful things, and a pair of running shoes. Nothing special. This morning, I had opened the smaller weapons crate and pulled out 2 knives identical to the one I lost yesterday. I also carried a leaf short sword, with a 22-inch long blade that was about 2.1 inches across in the widest part. At a pound and 11 ounces, it ran on the heavy side, and the weight and the leaf profile made it a good slasher. The cloak hid all that, but it couldn't hide Dakan, my spear. My grandmother had a huge problem with that name, because the closest translation of it to English would be stabby. She claimed it wasn't a proper name for a weapon, so after the first Dakan broke, I offered to name the new one Sharpie McStabbison, the son of Stabby, after which she groaned and left my quarters, followed by a throng of her advisors all giving me reproachful looks. Dakan rested in two parts in the sheath on my back. When screwed together, it reached 6 feet. The two shafts protruded over my right shoulder, easy to grab, and the sentry at the church door clearly had trouble figuring out why I was carrying two metal sticks on my back. After a few awkward seconds, he decided to stop pondering my weapon choice.
"How may I help you?"
I took out my order ID. "My name is Aurelia Ryder. I'm investigating Pastor Haywood's murder." The man flinched slightly.
"It's awful. It feels like a nightmare."
He caught himself.
"Would you mind waiting? The bishop is in residence and she may want to speak with you."
"I don't mind."
"Please follow me."
The inside of the church was 10 degrees cooler. Soothing light streamed into the reception area through the stained glass windows tinted in a dozen shades of blue and red. Through the open doors, I could see the inside of the church, rows and rows of wooden pews with cobalt cushions, the raised pulpit, and the simple wooden lectern upon it. There was no opulence in this church. Everything was well made, but restrained. I had done some reading on the topic of Methodists while riding the ley line to the city. The Methodists had always viewed healing as an important theological theme, and after magic had wrecked the world, they focused on it with even greater intensity. As a result, the Methodist congregation swelled, and there came a need to have a point person for large geographical areas, usually a bishop, sometimes elected, sometimes appointed. The bishop I was about to meet was responsible for the entirety of North Georgia. She could open many doors. She could also slam them shut. A side door opened, and a middle-aged woman in a beige business suit walked in, the man who had met me following close behind. The woman was in her mid-50s, with straight black hair cut in a flattering bob and features that hinted at East Asian heritage. The woman held her hand out.
"Hazel Chow, I'm the Methodist Bishop of North Georgia."
I shook her hand. She had a firm, dry handshake.
"Aurelia Ryder, Knight of the Order."
"A pleasure to meet you, although I wish it was under better circumstances. Why don't we talk in the garden?" I followed her through the side door, down a hallway, and through another door that led outside. We emerged into a large courtyard garden, with the cathedral directly behind us and auxiliary buildings on the three sides, each rising 3 stories high and topped by turrets on the corners.
"A good place to weather a siege," I noted.
"The old world is dying, and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters," she quoted.
"And monsters necessitate castles," I said, although I doubt Antonio Gramsci had our kind of monsters in mind. There were 2 translations of that quote, and as it often was, the least accurate one sounded the best. She gave me a surprised look and smiled.
"And I just showed my own bias. I didn't expect you to be well-read.
My family emphasizes education. Between stabbing people, of course."
"Of course."
She glanced at the man.
"It's okay, Gerald. I don't believe the knight will harm me. And if she tries, I'm not sure you could stop her anyway."
Gerald gave me a suspicious look and went inside. The bishop and I strolled down the path. On the right, bees buzzed around delicate pink flowers of mountain laurel. On the left, rhododendron bushes were ablaze with bunches of raspberry red blossoms. Blue-eyed grass and blue star bordered the path, offering purple and blue flowers.
They must have had beehives somewhere on the premises.
I will be blunt, Bishop Chow said. The death of Pastor Haywood was a devastating blow. On a personal level, he was one of my dearest friends. His contribution to the church and to the people of Atlanta cannot be overstated. Whoever killed him tore a gaping hole in our city. I will help you in any way I can.
Thank you.
In seeking answers, I have a responsibility to his congregation and to the city at large. He meant a great deal to a great many people. He was beloved, yet he was murdered with such shocking violence, and for unknown reasons. She had put a lot of emphasis on that unknown. Atlanta viewed Pastor Haywood as a saint. She had just warned me that if I found out any unsavory secrets that led to his murder, the responsibility for ruining the memory of the holy man would rest on my shoulders. Interesting. I had to stay in character, so it was my turn to reach for fancy quotes. "For each one will bear his own load," Bishop Chow glanced at me. Galatians 6:5. "My load is to discover who killed Pastor Haywood. His sins, whatever they were, are his load. Your load is to deal with the consequences of his loss. Think of me as a tool. I do not take sides. It's not up to me what people do with my findings."
"I see," Bishop Chow said. "Perhaps this is a conversation I should have with the Night Protector."
Oh, Nick would just love that.
"Perhaps."
If Pastor Haywood had done something sordid, the blow to the church would be devastating. Questions would be asked. Did the bishop know? And if she didn't, why not? Bishop Chow sighed.
"So how can I help you, Knight Rider?"
"Shortly before his death, Pastor Haywood was approached by a man about a holy artifact."
The bishop frowned.
"Really?
What kind of holy artifact?"
"My source isn't sure. They were preoccupied with cookies at the time. I do know that Pastor Haywood left in a car the next day and returned several hours later."
"Nathan?" Bishop Chow asked.
"Are you sure?"
"Why is that unusual?"
"He got carsick. He preferred to walk or ride a horse. Also, many of the people he ministered to didn't have a vehicle. He didn't want to set himself apart."
She smiled a sad little smile.
"He really did get terrible motion sickness, though. He vomited twice on the way to his own ordination. We had to coax him back onto the bus because he declared that since Jesus walked, so would he. And that was 30 years ago.
Magic fell.
Both of us paused, adjusting to the sudden absence of power. Technology had temporarily gained the upper hand. It wouldn't last, but meanwhile, I had fewer tools at my disposal.
So this artifact must have been very important to him?"
"Yes. I can't imagine what would make him get into a car, especially with someone he didn't know.
I don't understand why he didn't call me. He always called me about things like that."
"Was it common for Pastor Haywood to authenticate artifacts?"
Bishop Chow sighed again.
"It happened. Nobody likes to talk about it, but holy items are a big business, especially Christian relics. 99% of them are fake, but that 1% can perform miracles."
"Not all miracles were benign.
A few years ago, the rod of Aaron was found in Egypt. When cast down, it created an enormous, unkillable serpent that devoured several dozen people before the army finally managed to drown it."
"Nathan had the gift of discernment," the bishop continued, "but he was selective with his expertise.
5 years ago, the Catholics asked him to authenticate nail clippings from a saint because they wanted an independent expert. Unfortunately, the clippings didn't belong to a saint. They don't know where they came from, but they induced madness in the devout. Nathan lost 3 days to delirium. After that, he was very careful."
"And you're sure the request didn't come through the church?"
"Absolutely.
I will check, but since the clipping episode, all such requests are forwarded directly to me. So, either they approached him on their own, or she was lying. If she was lying, she was an incredible actress, because she seemed genuinely surprised.
"You have to understand," she said. "Nathan didn't care about money or prestige. Whatever they showed him had to be truly extraordinary.
Who are the most prominent relic hunters in the region? Who would have the kind of reputation that would lure a man like Pastor Haywood away from his church?" Her face twisted with disdain. I might as well have asked her who were the best pimps in the neighborhood.
"I would have said Waylon Billiott, but he died 3 or 4 years ago. Besides him, Daryl Knox and Dakota Mooney. Daryl and Dakota used to be married. They had some kind of falling out, and rumors say Dakota shot him in the upper posterior. Now they can't stand each other. There is also Mark Rudolph, who is extremely unpleasant. I'll ask Gerald to give you a list. It may take him a couple of hours."
"Thank you," I told her. "I'll come by later in the day and pick it up."
"These are not nice, reasonable people, Knight Rider. They are the kind of people who cross an ocean filled with monsters, climb into dark tombs filled with horrors, and then sell what they find to the highest bidder. They will shoot you for a dollar. If they decide that you are interfering with their business, they will retaliate."
"Thank you for your advice."
"Keep me in the loop," Bishop Chow asked. "Please."
"I will," I promised.
Tulip trotted down the deserted street. Behind me, towering poplars and oaks shielded the tall walls that guarded the houses of Tuxedo Park. Ahead lay urban ruins. After leaving St. Luke's, I'd turned south and then east, on West Paces Ferry Road. Soon it would cross the new Peachtree Road, and I would turn right again, heading south to Jesus Junction. Jesus Junction, otherwise known as the safest place in Atlanta, sat at the intersection of three roads, Peachtree, East Wesley, and West Wesley. It was a place where three churches formed a rough triangle: the Cathedral of Christ the King, the Mother Church of Catholic Archdiocese of Atlanta, Second Ponce de Leon Baptist Church, and the Cathedral of St. Philip, home to one of the largest Episcopalian congregations in the country. A good chunk of Buckhead lay in ruins, but Jesus Junction stood untouched, a beacon of safety among the chaos, the houses of worship protected from magic's teeth by the faith of its congregants. Pastor Haywood had worked with the Catholics before, and among all the Christian denominations, the Catholic Church bought the most relics and offered the highest prices. If I were selling holy artifacts, I'd tap the Catholics first. I had just passed the Atlanta History Center when I heard the jingling. It was an odd, disconcerting sound, as if someone had sharpened some metal coins and was now shaking them in a sack. I'd heard this before. Tulip flicked her ears. The jingling came again, insistent. Jingle, jingle. Scrape of metal on metal, sharp enough to make you cringe. Interesting. I brought Tulip to a halt. Let's see what happens. Two men stepped out into the road from behind the ruins of Regions Bank. The one on the left, 6 feet tall, with a beefy build and a gold chain around his tan neck, looked like a typical street tough guy, the kind who made his money collecting debts and carried brass knuckles in his pocket. He wore jeans, a tank top, and a custom pair of tennis shoes, handmade. A rifle hung off his shoulder. He was a large man, but next to the other guy, he looked like a child. The second man towered over the first by a good foot and a half. Huge shoulders, barrel chest, weirdly long arms bulging with muscle. He wore stained camo pants tucked into giant yellow boots and a brown tank top that left his shoulders bare. A 3.5-foot wooden club hung from his belt. Every inch of his visible skin was covered with dense red body hair, matching the greasy mane hanging from his head. His brutish face sported a permanent sunburn, except for the spots covered by his beard.
The two men strode to the middle of the street and stopped, blocking my way. The goon on the left wouldn't be a problem. His swagger told me he was strong and likely relied on brute force and his mass rather than speed and training. The giant next to him was another story. He moved like a man half his size, with a kind of animalistic smoothness. Like a bear, seemingly lumbering but big and fast, and hard to stop once he charged. Not good. With a club, his reach was longer than mine by half a foot. With magic up, he wouldn't have been a problem. But magic was down, and he outweighed me by at least 175 pounds. Jingle, jingle. Getting closer. The smaller man unslung his rifle and pointed it at me.
Don't move.
I'd picked this road to avoid traffic. Buckhead used to be an edge city, an uptown anchored by a cluster of high-rise hotels, offices, condominiums, and restaurants, none of which had fared well since the shift. It also spawned some nasty magic hazmat during magic waves. Like downtown and midtown, the area was a treasure trove for the reclamation crews, but downtown was safer, and so far, the city mostly left Buckhead to its own devices. These two weren't run-of-the-mill bandits. This road wasn't well used, and the persistent jingling told me they were a good way from home. Were they waiting for me? Why? I could shoot them now with my bow, but there was a good chance I'd kill them, and any answers would die with them. A huge dog trotted into view from behind the Regents building, 35 inches at the shoulder and slabbed with monstrous muscle. His chest was so deep and broad that his hindquarters looked like an afterthought. He gripped the ground with paws the size of melons. A single hit would crush a human skull. His head, with wide, oversized jaws, sat on a neck thicker than my thigh. Long metal spikes thrust from his skull, running all the way down his spine to the long tail. His fur was a forest of bluish metal needles. An iron hound. There was only one place in Atlanta it could have come from. The beast saw me. His turquoise eyes focused on my face. He opened his cavernous mouth, flashing 4-inch fangs, and snarled. The spikes snapped direct with a metallic screech. The dog took a step toward me and halted, brought up short by a thick chain wrapped around his throat. A moment later, its handler waddled into view. He was the smaller man's height, but the giant's weight, and he carried most of it in a beer gut. White, hairy, wearing denim overalls with no shirt. A machete hung in a sheath on his hip. He held the dog's chain in his left hand, and a second chain, stretching behind the building, in his right. The handler anchored himself, pulling the hound short, and yanked the other chain. A small body flew into view and landed at the handler's feet. Dougie. His face was a puffy bruise, his lips split, his right eye swollen shut. His hair was caked with blood. His jeans were shredded, and bloody flesh gaped through the holes. They had dragged him, scraping his knees raw. The chain was wrapped around his narrow waist, and it had worn the skin away from his ribs and stomach. He hadn't fallen the way a person would normally fall. He had collapsed like a rag doll, boneless and making no effort to catch himself. The world turned red in a single furious second. They'd beaten a child. They'd broken his bones. They put him on a chain. They dragged him across the city. The rage burned in me like a firestorm. The handler yanked the chain, lifting the child 3 feet off the ground.
"This her?"
No answer. The asshole shook the chain. The boy dangled like a broken doll. I would kill him slowly.
"Is this her?"
Dougie opened one eye to a mere slit. His voice was little more than a whisper. "No." The handler dropped him and looked at the giant.
"It's her."
If I showed the slightest interest or concern, they'd torture him to get me to behave. I had to shift their priorities. "Wow, the hills really do have eyes," I called out. And greasy hair. The giant peered at me.
You look like a good breeder.
You look like your parents met at a family reunion. His sidekick with the rifle frowned. Keep thinking. It will come to you. The handler bared yellow teeth at me.
Mouthy bitch.
My middle name. Did you finally get it? Don't be ashamed. It's hard to be the son of Sasquatch.
Dougie crumpled, forgotten on the ground. That's right. Focus on me.
Get off the horse and lie down on the ground,
the asshole with the gun ordered. I needed to get them away from the boy. I raised my arm and pointed at the gunman.
What's that? You gonna shoot me with your finger, you dumb bitch? Get off the horse and lie down on the ground. I'm not gonna tell you again.
I got off Tulip and tapped her with my hand. She trotted off to the side, out of the way. The three men watched me. Dougie lay still. I whistled once, a short, harsh note, and dropped to the ground. Turgon dropped from the sky like a stone, raking the gunman's face with his talons. The man shrieked. A shot rang out. I jumped up, dashed left, behind the Regent's building, and whistled again. The eagle streaked across the sky, soaring clear. The whole thing took less than 2 seconds. I pulled Dakan out and screwed the spear together. The building blocked the street. I couldn't see them, but they couldn't see me either. The gunman was still screaming.
Shut up,
the giant snarled, his voice cold and vicious.
It took my fucking eye!
A wet thud announced a punch landing.
Shut up or I'll crush your head.
The screams died. I moved east, circling the building, moving silently along the wall.
Larry, loose the fucking dog on her.
The chain clanked on the ground. I waited. The dog came around the corner, following my scent, his massive paws scraping the stone in a shower of sparks. Fangs flung spit into the air. The cavernous mouth opened wide. I stabbed Dakan into that gaping maw. The spear bit into the soft tissue inside the throat, slicing through muscle, cartilage, and bone into the brain. I jerked the spear free. The dog stumbled, his charge suddenly aborted. Blood gurgled, gushing from his mouth. I withdrew and drove the spear into its neck, cleaving the spinal column. The hound collapsed, its needles jingling like a sack of coins spilled on the ground. One down. I turned and kept circling the building.
Charger?
Larry called out. I rounded the corner and pressed myself against the wall. He was out in the street, just a few feet away. Dougie curled into a ball to Larry's right. Hold on. I'm coming. 20 yards down the street, in the direction I had been coming from, the shooter stared at the ruins. He gripped his rifle with his right hand. His left pressed some cloth against his injured eye. The giant was gone.
Charger, get back here, boy!
I lunged from behind the building and thrust the spear into the handler's back. The metal blade slid into flesh, ripping the kidney and liver on its way up. Larry gasped. I twisted the spear in the wound. He moaned in an oddly high voice. It would take him a long time to bleed out, and it would hurt every moment. He would never put another child on a chain. Larry's body jerked on my spear. A bullet bit into his stomach. The sound of the rifle was like the popping of a firecracker. Sudden lack of depth perception was hell on aiming.
Larry, get out of the way, the shooter yelled.
I spun Larry to my left, using his bulk as a shield, pulled the spear free, and sprinted back to the ruin. Behind me, the rifle cracked again, the bullet whizzing by to ricochet off a brick wall half a foot away. I ducked around the corner and kept moving, to the spot where two rectangular columns had once framed the entrance. I hid behind the first column and waited. The handler whimpered, fragments of incoherent words slipping out between his sobs.
Fuck you,
the shooter muttered from my right.
Fuck you, bitch, fuck you.
That's right. Come closer.
I'll fucking find you. I'll blow your head off.
A boot came into view.
I'll shoot you in both eyes and...
He gurgled as Dakan's blade slid through his neck. His remaining eye bulged, his mouth opened. He tried to say something, but blood was gushing from his throat, staining his skin bright red. A dark shape swung off the roof and dropped on top of me. There was no time to free the spear. I dodged left, desperately trying to get clear. A boot landed on my thigh. Pain exploded all the way to the bone. The glancing blow tossed me into the air like a rag doll. I flew, curling into a ball, straight into the soft embrace of a brick pile, and landed on my side. Ow! The world swam. I clawed through the fog of blurry vision. The giant was stomping toward me, brandishing his club. If I had been a touch slower, he would have broken my femur. I couldn't afford to be hit again. I jumped to my feet. The giant bore down on me, swinging the club, eyes cold. I shied left, then right, the club whistling inches from my face. He was between me and my spear, pushing me against the brick heap. If even a single blow connected, I was dead. He struck again and again. Left, right, left. I ducked, avoiding a blow, grabbed a brick off the pile and hurled it at his face. It hit him square between the eyes and bounced off. He roared, the red brick dust raining off his forehead. Fuck. He swept the club right to left. I dropped under his swing and ran right, the only way I could, leaping over refuse toward a side street. My legs screamed in protest. Every step hammered a hot spike of pain into my thigh. I reached the side street and glanced back. He hung the club back on his hip. Slowly, casually, the giant leaned forward onto his arms. Something in his pelvis shifted with a crack. The line of his spine realigned. He sprinted toward me on all fours. What the hell? He loped toward me in a familiar, disjointed gait, the kind of stride that the human body wasn't made for, but was unnaturally fast. In a fraction of a second, my mind crunched the numbers. He would catch me. I couldn't outrun him even if my leg wasn't on fire with pain. He gave me a head start because he knew it. He ran like a vampire. I would treat him like one. I pulled a knife from the sheath on my belt. My uncle's voice echoed in my head. Wait for it. Breathe. 20 yards. 15. 8. 3. Now, Hugh's voice commanded. I sidestepped. The giant's momentum carried him past, and I swung my knife straight down on the back of his neck. The blade bit into his vertebrae, slicing deep into cartilage. He rolled forward, blood drenching his shoulders and back, came up into a crouch and leaped at me. Son of a bitch! He should have dropped like a stone. He should have been paralyzed. I dodged, but not far enough. A huge arm swept me into a bear hug. I jerked my right arm up to keep it clear. He reared, yanking me off the ground, his arms crushing me. My ribs screeched with agony. The world turned black and fuzzy at the edges. I sank my knife into his eye. He howled, and I stabbed him in the ear. He flung me aside like a feral cat. I rolled clear and came onto my feet. Suddenly there was air. My lungs hurt with every breath. The giant rushed at me, flailing wildly, kicking, swinging, a bloody hole where his eye used to be. His neck gushed blood. I backed away toward the main street. He chased me, but his movements grew sluggish. Dodging him now was child's play. I walked him all the way to where the boy still lay on the pavement. The giant was breathing heavily now, each exhale a tortured gasp. I crouched by Larry's body and came up with his machete. A sudden realization flared in the giant's remaining eye. He turned. No, I told him. The giant stumbled away on shaking legs. I let him take 2 steps and sliced the back of his knees. Good machete. Sharp. The giant toppled like a felled tree. I walked in front of him. He was trying to crawl forward. I grabbed his hair and spun him around so he could see Dougie. The effort sent a blinding flash of pain through me, but I didn't care. I gripped the giant's hair and forced his head up. "Tell me who hired you and the pain will end," he growled. There was nothing human in the sound. His face was a mask of rage, but there was no power in it. His mouth drooped. His eyes stared, unfocused. "Tell me who hired you."
"Fuck you."
I wouldn't get anything from him. Dougie was looking at us with one eye. "Look at the boy," I told the giant. His hands were trembling. I yanked his head up, forcing him to look. Their stares connected. I brought the machete down on the giant's neck. This time the blade cut clean through the flesh and bone. The giant's head rolled clear. His eye was still blinking. His mouth moved, trying to shape words, but without lungs, nothing came out. I whistled for Tulip and scooped the boy off the ground. He was so light and limp.
"I didn't tell them," he whispered. "I didn't tell about you and Martin."
"I know.
It hurts.
I'm sorry. I've got you."
"Don't let them hurt me anymore," he whispered.
"They're all dead. I've got you." Tulip ran over. I draped him over her saddle on his stomach. It was the least jostling position. He moaned softly. "Stay with me, Douglas." He shivered. "Stay with me."
"Okay."
I grabbed the giant's head, shoved it into the saddlebag, ran to get my spear, and patted Tulip's cheek. "Smooth." Tulip started off. Most people were aware of four horse gaits: walk, trot, canter, and gallop. Those more familiar with horses knew about pace and amble, a four-beat intermediate gait between a walk and a canter. Tulip had her own amble, fast and smooth as silk. I had ridden dozens of horses, and none of them could match her. "Stay with me, Douglas." I ran next to her, trying to block out the pain and failing. The jolts of pain became a tortured cadence to my run. I sank into it, into a weird place where the hurt was background to the thing I had to do. Getting back to St. Luke's was the only thing that mattered, and when the church finally loomed in front of me, I was almost surprised. I pulled Dougie off the saddle and carried him up the steps to the doors. People came running out. Someone waved me to the right. "This way." I followed them through the church, through the garden, to the hospital, where people in scrubs took the boy out of my arms and carried him off. I waited on the bench by the reception area. Minutes ticked by. Bishop Chow came rushing through the doors past me and down the hall. A woman in scrubs came out to talk to her. A moment later, a door opened and a tall black man in scrubs walked out into the hallway. He and the bishop approached me.
"He's alive," the doctor said. "A broken leg, two broken arms, internal injuries. We will know more once we run the scans."
"Will he survive?"
"There are no guarantees. If we get a magic wave in the next few hours, his chances will improve."
"I will pay all the charges, whatever he needs." "No need," the bishop said. The doctor turned and hurried away. Bishop Chow sat next to me. "What happened?"
"A crew out of the honeycomb." Only honeycombers had iron hounds. "They were after me specifically. Yesterday, I talked to some street kids that witnessed Pastor Haywood leaving his church in a car to identify the artifact. The boy was one of them, kind of their leader. They beat him, chained him, and dragged him around the city trying to find me. They must have used the hound to track me to the church, and then either made a good guess as to which road I'd take out of it, or saw me leave and got ahead of me." Bishop Chow closed her eyes for a long moment.
"We will do everything we can."
"Thank you. And if anyone comes asking, call the order, please."
"You look like you might need to be checked out." I rose.
"Thank you again, but I have somewhere to be."
I started toward the doors. He didn't tell them about Martin, but that didn't mean they were the only people looking for her. I had to find her. "Ms. Ryder," she called after me.
Do be careful.
7. I walked into the orders chapter carrying my saddlebag. The female knight who had originally escorted me walked out of the nearest office. A slow smile stretched her lips. What truck ran you over? Did a child come here looking for me? The female knight nodded. Follow me. I followed her into her office. Martin sat in a chair, munching away on chocolate chip cookies and drinking from a large mug. She saw me and grinned, presenting me with chocolate-stained teeth. I slumped against the doorway. It had taken me almost 30 minutes to get to the chapter, and the entire time I was picturing Martin's broken body discarded like garbage in some ruin. Your bag is dripping, the female knight observed. I held the bloody bag up. She reached to the side, pulled a metal pan from a drawer, and placed it on her desk. I set the bloody bag into it. She sat behind the desk. The plaque on it said Stella Davis. I leaned against the wall and looked at Martin. What happened? She swallowed.
I went to get cookies.
She gave Stella a suspicious side eye.
In that place you told me about.
Clearly, the Knight of the Order couldn't be trusted with sensitive information like the location of the cookie stash. Stella rolled her eyes.
I ate a cookie and I hid the rest. Then I went back to the mouse house. There were two scary guys there and a taker there. They had a dog with iron fur.
The taker meant the highest level of danger, someone to run away from, someone who took the kids and they would never be seen again. What were the scary people doing?
Talking to Dougie.
Martin took another small bite from her cookie. Talking to this kid was like pulling teeth. Could you hear what they were saying? She nodded. Stella growled. What did you hear?
They were asking about the order woman. Dougie lied and said he would show them where you went. And then he went the wrong way and they followed him.
What did you do next?
I went to the secret place, got the cookies, and came here, like you told me to.
Stella glanced at me. She showed up here about 2 hours ago. She's eaten 3 giant cookies and drank almost a quart of milk. She looked at Martin. Where is it all going?
In my tummy.
Martin rubbed her bloated stomach and smiled. Then her smile fell.
Is Dougie okay?
Dougie got hurt, I told her. He is in the hospital now.
Can I see him?
I shook my head. I will take you later when he is feeling better. Nick Feldman loomed in the doorway.
What's going on here? Who is this child?
She's a material witness, I said. Nick pointed at my bag.
And what is this?
Evidence. He squinted at the bag.
Well, now I feel bad. I didn't get you anything. Why is your evidence bleeding all over Knight Davis's desk?
I stepped to the desk, opened the bag, and pulled it down. The two knights and Martin stared at the honeycomber's head.
The taker,
Martin said.
All humor evaporated from Nick's face. Pick that up and bring it into my office.
He turned and marched down the hallway. Stella leaned forward and whispered,
Ooh, you're in trouble.
Martin made big eyes.
Ooh!
I picked up the tray and followed the knight protector.
Close the door, Nick ordered, sitting down behind his desk.
I shut the door and put the tray in front of him.
Explain.
I brought him up to speed. Nick pondered the head, thinking.
I tapped the greasy head in front of me.
Who is he?
Jasper, no last name. Rapist, kidnapper, slaver. Do you know about Honeycomb?
I know they don't like outsiders.
It used to be a trailer park for retirees. Now it's a place that scrambles reality.
Honeycomb sat deep inside Honeycomb Gap, a fissure that cleaved the southeast of Atlanta. According to the city archives, before the shift, it was a nice place with pretty, white mobile homes and manicured landscaping. I had only seen it after the shift when it turned into a nightmare. Magic warped the trailer homes and splintered reality into pieces. The double and single wides multiplied, growing on top of each other like grapes in a bunch. Outsiders never went into the honeycomb without a guide.
It was a place where people accidentally walked through walls and never came out. One wrong step, and you were gone forever.
Nobody goes into Honeycomb, and the Honeycombers venture out into the city only when they need money, Nick continued. They're not picky. They'll do any shitty job that will pay cash. We don't even know how many of them are in there. Could be 10, could be 100.
What about Jasper?
Until this morning, Jasper ran it.
Nick leaned back.
Congratulations. You killed the King of Honeycomb.
Think he will be missed?
I doubt it. But I can't discount the possibility that you've just made yourself a target for revenge by a gang of deranged assholes. Low profile isn't really your thing, Ms. Ryder, is it?
Jasper didn't just happen to meet me, Night Protector. He tracked me down. Nobody knows me in the city, which means someone hired him to either look into the Haywood murder or make sure I didn't.
Nick grimaced. Probably the second. He was cunning in a way, but he wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed.
He also wasn't fully human in the strict definition of that word. Do you know who usually hires him?
He was what you might call an independent contractor. I'll tell Knight Davis to get you the list of known associates. Don't get your hopes up.
Nick fixed me with his stare again.
Do not go into Honeycomb. That's an order. You won't find any witnesses, and you won't get any information. Nobody will talk to you. They will walk you into a wall and you'll disappear.
On that, we agreed. Going into the Honeycomb was pointless. I was much better off trying to find out who hired Jasper. I didn't know what his employer's goal was, but I had a long bill to settle for Dougie's broken bones. I realized Nick was waiting for confirmation. I promise to not enter the Honeycomb. But if I were to hire someone from the Honeycomb, how would I go about it?
Nick sighed. Which part of not going into the Honeycomb was unclear?
I said I wouldn't. But they must hire them somehow. Do they just stand at the edge of Honeycomb Gap and scream at the top of their lungs?
Nick shook his head. There is a phone line.
Into the Honeycomb? How?
Nobody knows. Rumor says it works, and if you know the number, you can dial it and someone will pick up.
I stared at him. Nick shrugged.
You asked.
Do you know the number?
No. And if I did, I wouldn't tell you.
A faint idea began to form in my head.
Whatever you're thinking, I don't approve, he said.
Do you ever approve of anything?
Yes. Right now, I approve of you getting the hell out of my office. I will handle the Jasper fallout if any occurs. Do what you need to do, and don't get killed.
And here I was, planning to die a gruesome death. You've said that to me before.
I want you to really listen to me this time.
He dug into the drawer of his desk, took out a plastic jar, and shook two pills out onto his palm.
Here.
I held my hand out, and he dropped the pills into it.
Take this and get out.
I walked out. Nick Feldman had just gifted me prescription-strength ibuprofen. In post-shift world, the stuff was worth its weight in silver. Aw. I swallowed the pills and walked back to Stella's office. Martin crouched on the chair, crestfallen. What is it?
She's eaten all the cookies, Stella said dryly. Now she has a tummy ache.
The Night Protector told me to ask you for a list of Jasper's known associates.
Stella heaved a sigh and got up. Wait here. Don't touch anything.
She left. I looked at Martin. She looked back at me. Do you have a mom? I asked.
No.
A dad?
No.
Aunt, uncle, cousins, any living relatives? She shook her head. I had to keep her safe and off the streets. What was I going to do with her? I needed to find a secure place with someone who would watch her 24/7, because left to her own devices, she would take off. Someone strong enough to protect her from another Jasper. Stella returned with a single piece of paper. I glanced at it. Four names. An impressive file. A veritable cornucopia of information. I kept my voice casual.
Thanks. Also, the phone line into the honeycomb, is it more on the east or the west side of the gap?
West, just past Martha Street. I nodded to her and held my hand out to Martin. Come on.
She hopped off the chair.
Where are we going?
To see some nice people. They will keep an eye on you until it's safe. And they would also keep her from running away. She glanced up at me.
Will they feed me?
Absolutely.
Okay.
She took my hand, and we walked out of the chapter. The clerk of the Mercenary Guild waved me over to his counter. 8 years had passed, and he looked exactly the same, as if I had seen him yesterday. Average height, average build, tan skin, brown hair, perpetually around 45. He looked like a seasoned bartender, calm, reserved, and ready to whip out the shotgun from under the counter and blast whatever broke through the guild's giant metal doors. Nobody remembered his name. He was just the clerk, in charge of assigning gigs, tracking down mercs when special jobs came in for them, and handling other mundane admin tasks. He had always been there, and I suspected he always would be. The clerk saw Martin holding my hand and smiled. Martin smiled back. For a little kid, Martin was very aware of her cuteness, and she weaponized it. On our way here, I'd stopped at the 75 market and bought her 3 changes of clothes, toiletries, and a backpack. Somehow, she had ended up with a small bag of candy, a strip of jerky, and a peach, all freely gifted by the stallkeepers. If she'd been allowed access to the market, she wouldn't be this thin. But normally, the market security chased street kids out. My presence validated hers, and my face smoothed away any doubts anyone might have had. People treated you differently when you were beautiful. Fucked up, but true.
How can we help you? The clerk asked.
I'd like to see Barabbas Gilliam.
Do you have an appointment?
No, but I have money.
The clerk nodded.
Let me see what I can do.
I stepped back a bit. The clerk lifted the phone, spoke into it, and waved us over again.
He'll see you in about 15 minutes, if you don't mind waiting.
We don't mind. Martin and I walked to a client reception area to the left and slightly in front of the clerk's counter, where several padded chairs were arranged in a horseshoe around a coffee table. From his counter, the clerk could keep an eye on us and on the front doors. In its previous incarnation, the guild used to be a luxury Buckhead hotel, a hollow tower with an atrium in its center. The top of the tower had broken off long ago, gnawed to a nub by magic, and then pummeled by a giant. The renovations had stabilized the building, but the height was capped at 5 floors. Anything taller and you risked magic erosion. Now the former hotel served as a base for about 300 mercenaries, housing an armory, containment cells, storage, barracks, a sick bay, and everything else muscle for hire might need. Behind us, a food court occupied a good chunk of the floor. Several rough-looking people ate at the tables, some alone, some in groups. The air smelled like fresh bread, cooked meat, and strong coffee. After Curran gave up being Beast Lord, he found himself the majority owner of the Mercenary Guild. His first act was to fix the food. Shapeshifters ate a lot and often. Martin sniffed.
Smells yummy.
I thought your tummy hurt.
It's all better now.
Stella was right. This girl was a bottomless pit.
We waited. Barabbas occupied a large office on our left, behind a glass wall. Normally the door was open, and you could see him working at his desk through the glass. Today, the plantation shutters behind the glass blocked the view and his door was closed. He must have wanted privacy. Nobody bothered us. The mercs kept to themselves. They teamed up for larger jobs, but most of them were lone wolf types. They handled jobs the cops wouldn't or couldn't. Anything from hostile magic hazmat removal to bodyguard detail and armed escort. They drew the line at assault and murder for hire, and generally tended to stay on the good side of the law. But aside from that, any job was fair game if it paid enough. I casually glanced at the exposed ceiling beams high above us. Empty. The door of Barabbas's office swung open slightly as someone paused with one hand on the door handle. A low male laugh, a deep rumble came from the gap. Curran. I swept Martin into my arms and made a beeline for the women's restroom. Behind me, the door swung open with a faint creak. Don't run, don't run, don't run. Curran was a cat. If I ran, he would notice. I pushed the restroom door open and we ducked inside. I leaned against the door and braced myself. A long moment passed. Another. Martin blinked at me and said in a hushed voice,
"Why are we hiding in the bathroom?"
"We are not hiding. We're executing an evasive maneuver."
"Why?"
"Because it's to our strategic advantage." Martin nodded. Excited voices came muffled through the door. Curran laughed again. It was taking every iota of my willpower to keep the door closed. He wouldn't recognize me. Of course he wouldn't. But if he did, I would have a lot of questions to answer. I wasn't sure I could lie to Curran, and if I tried, he would probably know. The voices receded. Someone yelled, "And stay out, you beach bum!" More laughter followed. Finally, it died down. I waited another half a minute and came out of the bathroom. Barabbas's door was open. The shutters were up, and I saw him sitting at his desk, his blazing red hair standing on end like hedgehog needles. "He'll see you now," the clerk called. I walked into Barabbas's office, set Martin into one of the two client chairs, and took the other. Barabbas looked up. He had an agile face with angular features and smart green eyes. His skin, so pale it was a wonder he didn't glow at night, resisted a sunburn with the power only Like V could muster. He wore a suit despite the heat, but he'd taken the jacket off and rolled up the sleeves of his blue dress shirt, exposing lean, muscular forearms. Everything about him seemed quick and sharp. "Don't hold your breath. Act natural. You don't smell the same." Barabbas studied me and Martin.
"What can I do for you?"
I put a narrow gold bar on his desk. It was about the length of my finger, half an inch wide and half an inch tall. Barabbas's eyebrows crept up. He picked up his phone.
"Charles, I need you for a second."
A moment later, an older Hispanic man walked through the door. He picked up the bar, looked closely at it, and put it down.
"Real?"
Barabbas nodded, and Charles left without another word. The guild master steepled his fingers in front of him.
"The guild is at your disposal."
"For 20 grand, it better be." "This is Martin." Barabbas held out his hand.
"A pleasure to meet you, Martin. I'm Barabbas Gilliam. I run the guild."
Martin gave him a little wave, but kept her hands to herself. "Martin is a street kid," I told him. "She doesn't trust anyone, especially adult males."
"A good policy."
Barabbas leaned back in his chair. "I need you to guard her."
"Do you have any legal authority over this child?"
I knew this was coming. Before taking charge of the guild, Barabbas had been a pack lawyer. "No. However, she has no living relatives. She is an orphan living on the street. I didn't kidnap her." Barabbas turned to Martin.
"Are you an orphan?"
"Yes."
"She's a witness to a murder." Technically, that wasn't true, but explaining the details would take a while, and Barabbas didn't need to know them. "Violent people are looking for her."
"How long do you expect her to require protection?"
"A week." Barabbas glanced at the gold bar.
"You're overpaying by at least half, possibly more."
"I think you misunderstood. I want you to guard her. You, personally, or..." Crap. I wasn't supposed to be on a first-name basis with either of them, and Barabbas and Christopher had gotten married after I left. Who took whose last name? Was it Christopher Gilliam, Christopher Steed, or Christopher Gilliam Steed? Or Christopher Steed Gilliam? If I said the wrong thing, it would mean I knew them from before they had gotten married. Barabbas would never let that slide.
A member of your family?
Yes, dodged that bullet.
Hence the higher fee. Should she require protection after 1 week, I'll return with a similar payment.
It would put a dent in my immediate funds, but it was worth it.
What if you don't come back?
Then I expect you to do what you feel is right. You have a reputation as an ethical man.
Barabbas pondered the gold, glanced at Martin, and looked back at me.
Very well. I have just the person.
He raised his voice slightly.
Sophia!
Martin eyed him. The door swung open, and a teenage girl walked in, with a backpack hanging off one shoulder. She looked about 14, athletic build, dressed in shorts and a tank top, a pair of ruby red sunglasses perched on her head. Her hair, pulled back into a short ponytail, was the lightest shade of platinum blonde. Barabbas was pale, but she was porcelain white, and her eyes, fringed by white eyelashes, had an odd lavender tint. An albino.
Father?
This is my daughter, Sophia, Barabbas said.
Barabbas had a daughter? And Conlan hadn't told me?
Pleased to meet you,
Sophia said.
She is a member of my family, and she is uniquely qualified for this assignment.
A red sheen rolled over Sophia's eyes, and for a second, I saw the outline of a long horizontal pupil before it contracted into a human round shape. A were-mongoose, like Barabbas. Albinism in humans was rare, roughly 1 in 17,000. In mammals, it occurred slightly more often, about 1 in 10,000. Albinism in shapeshifters didn't exist. Albinos carried a higher risk of sunburn and skin cancer, and the lack of eye pigmentation sometimes caused vision problems that required corrective surgery. It was theorized that like V removed albinism in the womb, though there was no consensus on how exactly it did that. I had seen thousands of shapeshifters, not a single albino among them. There was only one way for Sophia to exist, and that way was very illegal. Barabbas knew that better than anyone. What did you and Christopher do, and how in the world did you get away with it?
Qualified for what? Sophia asked.
Bodyguard detail, 24/7, 1 week, Barabbas said.
Overtime?
Pay and a half.
Hazard bonus,